made.
Hello, friends. It's that time again. Welcome back to the podcast. Today's a little different tone. I lost a very close friend a couple of weeks ago, and not going to lie, it took a significant toll on me emotionally. Not that I didn't anticipate that it would, but I think it hit me a little bit harder than I was expecting it to, and I've kind of been processing that. And so part of that processing is just kind of telling his story and making sure that his story is a part of my life, the rest of my life, but that as many people as I can have hear his story and grow from that story. I feel an obligation to him for as much as he's given to me, but also an obligation to people hearing and taking from his story. I have never really had the benefit of a positive male role model. I never had, hell, I didn't even know what a role model was really until much later in life. And so I have spent my entire life looking. The first stage of life was more of a subconscious search, finding myself attracted to different ideas, different people, not even really knowing that I was allowing those to fill the position of role model in my life, and that I was taking things practically and philosophically from their messages to help me get through life. And then as I became more intentional about that, the first role model that I had in my life was not even a person. It was the music of John Mellencamp. And I just resonated with a little bit of what I consider his music to fall into three categories. One is just kind of a hedonistic sort of pleasure seeking. Another is more of just kind of the grit of life and grinding life out. And then he kind of ventures into some social justice sorts of themes. And so he has a song called Minutes to Memories that, I mean, I have listened to death, and have to this day the philosophy of the words of the song, and also the just the straightforward message of the song. But then, like, in my late 30s, early 40s, I became more intentional of seeking out a role model, and what kind of a man did I want to be, and answering that question directly. And oddly enough, that led me to being completely fascinated with Mr. Rogers, Fred Rogers, as we all know from our childhoods, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, that sort of stuff. Watched it as a kid, but really didn't know what I was. I just watched it. I think that's just because, truth be told, maybe just one of the only children's programs that I had access to. And a client of mine many moons ago gave me a book. It's kind of one of those coffee table books called The Wisdom of Mr. Rogers or something like that. And that was kind of my re-entry into, Mr. Rogers. I haven't thought about him in a long time. And I, more of a kind of a courtesy to this client, I just kind of started flipping through the pages and reading it, and was like blown away by the wisdom of what he said, and then started just kind of exploring more who his life was, what he did in life, how controversial his show was in terms of what he did for quote unquote handicapped and what he did for race relations, and that he was actually a pretty fierce motherfucker, disguised as a gentle yet meek individual. And then I met my friend Craig, and Craig, upon first meeting him, he struck me with that same presence of Mr. Rogers. There was a gentleness about him, but it was by no means a weakness. It was an intentional gentleness, and it was a durable, fierce gentleness. And we had a friend that was a mutual friend who was an attorney, and he asked me if I would take on this case, which I did. And so then I started to get to know Craig, and there was a period of time where he was, when I met him and started working with him, he had debilitating anxiety. And he was restricted to living at home. He didn't leave his home. And so when you first meet him, hear his story, you think, oh my God, you know, here's a guy that's pretty weak and controlled by his anxiety. And like, you know, you start the same old protocol of systematic desensitization and cognitive behavioral therapy, all of those kinds of things to expand his world. And just in, as I spent time with Craig, I could tell there was a very conscious, very intentional feeling me out and seeing how much genuineness there was in me, how much was I just a therapist and was he just another client. And as we spent more time together and built trust, Craig let me behind the veil and let me know what the true story was. And Craig was a elementary music school teacher, and he also was gay. And he used music to, and his role as a teacher to meet children where they were emotionally. And through his giftedness, take them first to a place of comfort that they were not receiving in their own lives. And then he used music and their exploration in music to take a child from a place of where they were to a place they didn't think that they could be by singing a song or understanding a song or being moved by a song. And his goal was not to get them to pursue a life in music. His goal in life was to take them from a place of insecurity and doubt to a place of security and comfort. And then in that place of security and comfort, ask themselves, what else could I become? What else might I be capable of? And I remember him telling me a story, and I think this was the second time that Craig and I ever got together. And he even asked permission. He said, do you mind if I tell you a story about one of my students? And I said, no, please do. And, you know, at this stage, we're still feeling him out, feeling each other out. He's definitely feeling me out, and I'm definitely trying to just be as genuine and as present as possible and earn the trust that he's wanting to give me. And so he told me the story, and he said it was a particular day where, you know, young kids, everybody's just batshit crazy and nobody's listening. And he finally had said, okay, heads down, turned the lights out, you know, we're just going to chill for a minute. And he said this particular boy in class that was a quote-unquote problem child, like he was known to come from a very difficult family of origin, and he struggled and acted out and all the sorts of stereotypical things that we might associate with such a young boy. And so Craig's trying not to get completely exasperated with the class and trying to get everybody to chill the fuck out. And as he turns the lights out and has everyone put their heads on their desk, and the little boy raises his hand, and Craig tries to put him at bay, put your hand down, it's quiet time. And he said, but Mr. Early, I really need to do something. And so Craig finally gave in and said, okay. And so the little boy walked up to Craig and leaned in and put his cheek on Craig's cheek and just sat there for a minute. And he said, thank you. I just really needed to do that. And when Craig told me that story the first time, he walked over to me and he put his cheek on my cheek and he demonstrated what this little boy had done. And there was something incredibly profound that happened in that moment of him telling me the story and sharing that profoundly intimate moment and the courage that it took for Craig to tell that story, but then demonstrate it the way that he had experienced it. And to be completely candid, I was caught off guard. There was such a vulnerability in that moment that I don't know how to say it other than caught me off guard. And that moment changed our relationship from therapist client to two men who had something to learn from each other. And as we progressed in our relationship, he began to tell me the story about why he wouldn't leave the house. And I don't know that I want to particularly tell the details of the story other than it involved an egregious hate crime by a police officer and ended up costing Craig everything. Ended up costing him his self-respect. It ended up costing him his career. It ended up costing him the life that he had created for himself. And the beauty that he did in the lives of so many. And as I started to understand his story and understand why he was having some delusional thoughts and why he was struggling with anxiety, it completely changed the tone of our work. And I began to learn more from Craig about life, about love, about strength, about courage than I had ever learned from anyone. But he was the personification of the gentleness, the strength, and the courage of Mr. Rogers. And so suddenly I find myself in a 12-year relationship with someone that is actually living out the archetype of masculinity that I had aspired to but had only experienced through the pages and the video clips of Fred Rogers. And suddenly I find myself in this position where I'm supposed to be the therapist and I'm supposed to be enriching and building and expanding his life. And I find that I now am the one being taught. And through that friendship and that love that we developed for each other, we were able to accomplish profound things in each other's lives. I was able to help him conquer the war that was in his mind that was creating the anxiety. And he taught me the fierceness of true love and the fierceness of true courage. And for Craig, it wasn't the bravado of a gym body or professional success the way that we normally think about professional success. It was a profoundly beautiful life, incredibly well lived. When Craig lost his job and he moved back to Southern Indiana to take care of his father and his aging mother, and his father had passed away before I started working with Craig, but I did get to meet his mother, Mary, and Mary was, she was in her late 80s, early 90s when I first met her. And as sharp of a human being as I have ever met, she devoured presidential biographies, like thousands of pages long, and just was a voracious reader, and what an incredible thinker. And I would get to spend time with Mary, and she would tell me stories from the Great Depression and what life was like for her 90 years of life, and just became so fond of Mary. And in the time of working with Craig, Mary passed, and she was ready to pass. She was ready to, she had lived a life well, and she had no regrets, and just such a beautiful person, and certainly passed that beauty on to Craig. And I remember a particular day when I went to see Craig, and he was sitting on the floor and he had his iPad in his lap, and he was just sobbing. And so when I went in and sat down beside him, he asked if I would watch this video clip with him. And I said, of course. And so he pushed play, and on the screen, this woman was singing opera, and it was an Italian opera he was familiar with. Craig was infinitely sophisticated in his understandings of music, of architecture, of food, of all things. So we sat there on the floor and we listened to this woman sing, and it was it just was a gripping performance. It touched you in a very somber, very profound way. And so before I knew it, I was sobbing. And so we're both sitting there just enveloped in this experience. And as it concluded, and I was able to contain myself, I asked him what just happened here. And he explained that the woman, the song that she was singing was actually a prayer, and roughly translated, she was saying that she lived for love and she lived to create. And to her knowledge, she had never done harm to another living thing. And then in that moment, the tone changes extremely, and she says, "God, why are you allowing this to happen to me?" And then a profound tragedy happens to her in the opera. And it was such an incredible parallel to Craig's life. I live to love, I live to create was certainly Craig's anthem that he lived his life by. And to my knowledge, I've never done harm to another living thing. If anyone could ever make that claim, it was Craig Early. And he would absorb harm before he would harm someone else. In certain instances where it would have been justice for him to stand up and protect himself, but he chose always to prevent from doing harm to someone else. And time went by, and Craig and I continued our work together, and it resonated to me, just that song and the parallel of his life and the beauty of his life and the tragedy of his life. And it was just so heartbreaking for me that someone so beautiful, that had done so much good, could endure such tragedy. And at this time, we had developed, again, a profound friendship and a profound love for each other. And I asked Craig if he would write the words out to that phrase in Italian, just if you would just write that out. And so he wrote it out for me in Italian, and I just, you know, I just contemplated those words, and I thought about Craig, and I thought about our friendship and my love for him and what he had done for me in my life and what I had hoped to reciprocate in his life. And so I had decided that I wanted to get a tattoo on my arm with his words, with those words in his handwriting. And a lot of time had passed, and I had a couple of opportunities to get the tattoo, wasn't able to do it, but I'd finally, the guy that has done all of my tattoos was finally able to get me in. And so I'd gone up to see Craig, and I'd talked to him, spent time with him, and I told him, you know, tomorrow afternoon, I'm going to get the tattoo. And he was like excited about it. He's not a tattoo guy, but was, you know, flattered by the gesture and like, cool, I'm glad you're getting that tattoo. And so that Friday I go and I get my tattoo and tell the tattoo artist the story. And so he does the tattoo, and it's beautiful, and it represents exactly what I wanted to represent. And it's impeccably Craig's handwriting. So every part of it was just fantastic. And I was just excited about it, excited what it meant to me, excited to share it with my friend Craig. And I got a phone call that Sunday that Craig had had a massive stroke. or a seizure. I apologize. Had a massive seizure, and he was lying in a coma. And the moment was just so, it just was so, caught me off guard. It was like, what? Like, how? I just saw him on Thursday. How can he possibly be in a coma? What? And you start, you know, in moments like that, your thinking becomes completely irrational. Like, did I like upset the universe by getting a tattoo? And what, you know, so all the irrational thinking. And so I went to see him on Monday, and he was laying in a hospital bed with a breathing tube, and he was non-responsive. And I sat there and I just held his hand and told him how much I loved him and that this was not the end, because we had so much more to do together and experiences to have. And so I went for several days, and he had not been responding. And so I went up on a Thursday, and I was standing by the bed, and I was holding his hand, and he woke up, and it was completely unexpected. I mean, I certainly didn't expect him to regain consciousness, but he woke up, and he was alert, and he was terrified. And so I spent several minutes just kind of explaining to him what had happened and why he was in the hospital and what was going on. And he was lucid, had his wits about him, understood, like he was nodding his head. And so we were talking, and I had the moment to show him the tattoo, and like, here's the tattoo. I hope you like it, because we're stuck with it. And we laughed and we cried, and we just had these wonderful moments together. And he wanted something, and I couldn't figure out what he wanted. And he was like gesturing with his head downwardly. And so his foot wasn't covered. So I was like, oh, your foot must be cold. I'll help you get it covered. And he was like, no, that's not what I wanted. And you know, when you can't understand somebody, you're trying to talk them into, no, it's your foot. Your foot's cold. You want me to? And so finally I figured out he wanted the TV on. And so we're trying to figure out what he wants to watch, and we're laughing, and he's giving me shit with his blinks, and I'm giving him shit. And the nurse came in, and I had to get back to the office, but they were talking about transitioning off of the breathing tube. And they were, I'd spoke with his sister later that evening or the next day, and they were talking about discharge, and were suddenly like, holy shit, discharge, where are we discharging and what are we doing? And so it's just this whirlwind of emotion, and like this hope that I'm going to get to spend more time with my friend Craig. And so I had some interaction with him, with his sister, and just keeping me up to speed. And so the weekend came, and then that next week, it was the week of 4th of July, I got a text from his sister asking if I could call her. And I knew, however you know these things, when I got the text that Craig had, something had happened. And so I called, and her first comments were, this is not going to be an easy phone call. And I broke down. I just, however you know, you know. And she told me the story that they were trying to transition him off of the breathing tube, and every time he couldn't keep up, and so they'd have to put the breathing tube back in, and the trauma of putting the breathing tube back in and taking it back out, and just, he was in so much discomfort, and she just couldn't keep doing this to him, and his brain had suffered so much. He had had a stroke previously, and now the seizure, and they had made the decision to not try to prolong his life and just let him pass, and he quickly passed, and it was the most horrible news that I had heard in my life, that I wasn't going to get to see my friend Craig again. And it shook me like I'd never been shook before. And so it just kind of sent me on this kind of time of processing of, and I remember thinking, for whatever reason, the concluding scene of the movie Private Ryan, where the guy is standing at the grave and he comes back to his wife and asks him, "Have I been a good man?" And I just remember thinking that, like, have I been a good man? Have I honored my relationship with Craig? Was I as good to him as he was to me? Did I give to him as much as he gave me? And you, in those moments, of course, you just always doubt yourself and the what ifs, and I should have done this and I should have done that. And as I was talking with some other people and just trying to make sense of my emotions and trying to just hold on to my experience with Craig, one of the therapists that I'm in a group with suggested that in part me being there when he woke up and having the tattoo and sharing what I've shared with him for the last 12 years and sharing what I shared with him in those moments may have been enough. That was part of just kind of his ending. That those final moments were enough to give him the peace that he needed. And I'm still very much reflecting on what I learned from Craig and the growth. But in one of the most unlikely places, a profound man taught me more than I ever thought that I even had to learn about what it really means to be a man. Jordan Peterson, if you follow him, if you don't, whatever. He's an interesting individual, but he talks about, he kind of gives a spin on the meek shall inherit the earth, and he talks about meek, and he redefines it as a meek man is a powerful man under control. And that's part of implicitly what is in the implication of being meek. And as I look at the life of Craig, Craig was most assuredly the personification of meek. Incredible power, incredible intellect, and yet so beautifully gentle, and yet so committed to creating love and creating beauty. And he did that in a most honorable way. And I know for me, I will spend my life aspiring to live up to the example that he set, not for any other reason than the way that he lived his life and the man that he was and the gift that he gave me of what it means to be an authentic man, to love dangerously. It's not about income. It's not about title. It's not about a suit or fitness or any of those sorts of things. It's about the courage to love dangerously and restoratively. And I will be forever grateful for my friend Craig.